Getting started. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the weekly meeting of the Berkeley branch of the International Socialist Organization. Today's meeting is about organizing to stay in Kevin Cooper. So we're going to have a speaker for about 25 minutes and then we'll open it up to discussion. Do you want to get over?
All right, so I'm Cameron Sturman. And is there who here is not a member of the ISO? So there's two people who are not members. Okay. So I really geared this. Can we roll our table down that way? Because I feel like
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I feel like the Titanic is tilted and we all just flipped to one side and the boat stayed over here. So I really kind of geared this for what I thought would be an audience that was a little maybe more undecided, a little more not already part of the organization. So I'm not going to just speak to you two, but because I think that what we're going to talk about actually has relevance for members of the group as well. So I wanted to get started by first of all just saying, why now? Why have this conversation now? And then why are we having this conversation? The first part, of course, is that Prop 62 and Prop 66 are on the California ballot, and that is a brick wall in which everything that has to do with anybody's case down the road, including Kevin, is racing towards that wall. It could be very important, like how we think about that. I talked with our district organizer and tried to find out if our district or the state of California ISO chapters have taken a position yet on the proposition. The answer that I got back was it doesn't look like we have. So I think this is also an open debate. It's a good time for us to form our kind of our approach to this as well. So just to get it out of the way, Prop 66 is a total no-brainer. Everybody, if you're not registered to vote, you should register and you should vote no on 66. That's the one that's endorsed by like every prosecutor and sheriff in the state, and is basically designed to speed up the execution process by mandating appellate attorney assignments, and then also really limiting the number of appeals and the routes to appeal that are available. It would be similar to saying, like, who here has a driver's license? I thought about this, I don't know if it's voice or driver's license. Who has a driver's license? Anybody else who has a driver's license? Now, I'm presuming that all of you feel like you'd be a little bit scared with your driver's license. So then we said, you are going to drive this 18-wheeler, triple piggy truck from here to, like, Nebraska. Because you have driver's license, right? So that means you can operate a motor vehicle, right? Because part of what Prop 66 would do is that any attorney who accepts any pro bono work, or who does any work on any kind of thing, could be put into a pool, and they would be assigned to work on capital one case. So, any pound in your hearing. And the cases that we work on, the campaign in the current cases in California, are right with examples of how problematic this is, to say the least. For example, the guy I worked with, Raymond Lewis, right after he was convicted for capital murder, his attorney was then disbarred in the state of California because it turned out that through the entirety of Raymond's trial, he was doing coke and embezzling from his other clients to pay for the cocaine. When that was raised as like a possible impeachment of his ability to actually represent and put his full focus on Raymond's case, he was fighting for his life, that's 62 is much more interesting. And that's what I'm probably going to spend more time on, and we'll talk about Kevin's case and use that Kevin's case as a prism to look at 62 and vice versa at Kevin's case through 62. 62 converts would do away with the death penalty and change it to life without the possibility of parole in California. That's the main thing. It does other things. It mandates work. It mandates restitution. But the main thing that 62 does is it does away with the death penalty and it replaces it with life without possibility. All right. So why? Those are the two things that I think are why the motive force behind why look at this issue now. Why Kevin's case is so important. So why us, or even why me? I remember 20 years ago being on the Cal campus when we decided as the ISO to support the formation of a campaign to end the death penalty in California.
It's a great idea. The reason we did it was because we saw a huge amount of racism in the criminal justice system, and we thought, where is a place that we can help to expose this racism and actually make a difference inside this massive incarceration movement that's happening? And the campaign to end the death penalty was something that was going on, and so we decided to get involved in it, and that's us. The very first case I worked on was 1996, William Bonin. Did anybody here grow up in California? From Southern California at all, the three-way murders in the late 70s. This guy, undoubtedly, William Bonin did rape and murder at least 14 young boys and men, and brutally so, and then left their bodies on the freeway. It happened over a couple of years. And that's the first case that we worked on here in California. And I, in some ways, I think it's instructive because it helped us immediately clarify how are we going to approach this kind of a, you know, cases in general, but this case in particular. As with all cases, once you actually start to look at the background of what actually happened and what was happening to the people involved, it becomes much less clear that the death penalty is going to do anything. So I'll start off with that case, but I want to just buttress it with six reasons why the death penalty is wrong, why I want to convince all of you to be anti-death penalty people and to vote no on 66 and to have us a full discussion on 62. The first one is that it's racist. It kills the poor. It is condemns the innocent to die. It's cruel and unusual punishment. It's not a deterrent to crime. And we added a sixth one. That's what we said to start off with the environment. As a sixth one fairly recently. And the sixth one is that it fails to recognize that people can change. Even the guilty can change, and that there is the death penalty denies them a possibility of that change and of actually rejoining society. Those are the six pillars. But I want to come back to the first case we worked on. So William Bonin, it turns out, served two active tours of duty in Vietnam. We don't even want to know what he did while he was there. We know that he was convicted after he returned of several sexual assaults on women and on boys. He was in a Tuscadero State Mental Hospital when Reagan decided that deinstitutionalization was the way to approach mental health. And basically, William Bonin, like in his discharge, he didn't say this, but basically, if you read the discharge, it basically is he's saying to the court, I'm not better, don't release me. But he's released anyway. And then he goes on to commit these really heinous and horrible acts. And so the argument that we put forward was, who's responsible here? The people, the military, for training him how to kill, sending him to be actively involved in killing in Vietnam, for the who even knows what he did to Vietnamese people while he was there. We have a pretty good guess because he did a bunch of really bad stuff in the United States. When he was hospitalized and then was released, like who's where does the line of responsibility fall back to in those cases? Even though we put that argument forward, I think it was a good argument, we lost that case. I want to say that of the 11 cases we worked on, I worked on personally every one of the subsequent cases that happened in the state of California. We lost every single one of those cases except for Kevin Cooper's. And in many of those cases, there was always, if you just looked even just one step back, if you double-clicked on any of those cases in the background, you would find immediately a societal responsibility for what was being attributed to an individual failing. So let me come back to some of these other points, though. It's racist. In California, 33% of the people on death row are white, which means that 66% of the people on death row are something else. 36% are black, and 24% are Latino, and then 5% are other. Even though our state's population, that's completely skewed from our state's population, but it's even more than that. Who gets the death penalty in the United States depends much more on the race of the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, and on
on the race of the victim. Even though African Americans are 50% of the murder victims in the United States, you don't get capital punishment for killing a black person. You get capital punishment for killing a white person, especially if you are black. I will say it's very easy to do two things when you're talking about the death penalty. It's very easy to either get very legal or get very quant. Who's an MBA? Is there an MBA? Is there a business school people in here? Or social science, you know, it's very easy to get involved in the quant of this study, quantifying it and measuring it. And you can, the death penalty lends itself to being assessed with statistics. There's a lot of stats in the Department of Corrections on who did what and when, where, and how. I'll just say it's tempting to go down two rabbit holes with that, but I want to keep us back up the top. So I'll use some stats, but I don't want to just have this be a stat and legal argument. But it is it's overwhelmingly the case that racism plays a huge part, and the statistics totally bear that out, not just in California, but across the United States. And maybe other people can bring up some of the stats. Have the highest rates of violence and murder. So it just is not even sure that that's not even true. The next thing that I kind of want to talk about is, especially now in Kevin Cooper's case, just what went wrong. And the most important thing, I guess, I visited Kevin a lot early on, and not so much now, but a lot in his early part of his case. And he always said, you know, I'm not asking you to believe that I'm innocent. I'm just asking you to look at what happened in my case. And it is like one nonstop racist disaster. Now, I'm not going to read this whole thing, but I did bring the fact sheet, and you can look at savekevincooper.org to get all of this stuff. It's exhaustive. There's been a book written about it. But basically, what happened was Kevin Cooper walked away from a minimum security prison in California. Went to a house, stole a car, and went to Mexico. The same night that he was sleeping in a house next door in San Bernardino, next door in San Bernardino County means a horse ranch next door, which means like several acres away. The Ryan family was brutally murdered. It was two adults and two children, one child survivor. And they died within 4 minutes using four different murder weapons. So four murder weapons in 3 minutes, all ascribed to one person. This is battling two healthy adults. Peggy Ryan, they were both horseback riders. Mr. Ryan was an ex-Marine, 200 pounds. They both had loaded weapons, and they were avid firearms people, and they had loaded weapons in their home. So we're supposed to believe that Kevin Cooper killed four people in 3 minutes using three weapons. To do what? To steal a car. The Ryan's car, they had two cars in the garage, in the driveway. Both of them had their keys they weren't in the ignition, but they were in the car. Credit cards and money in plain sight that was left at the murder scene. So, are you going to say that it was motivation, money, or cars? Suffice it to say that there was a tunnel vision approach to putting him in the car. What had happened subsequent to that is, I brought along that. It's a 57-page dissent by a federal judge talking about what is wrong with the way Kevin Cooper was tried. And I just want to say, I've seen a lot of cases where they are never 57 pages of a judge who's basically going after the entire court saying, this is a, he starts off by saying, that's part of the whole thing. The very first sentence of the dissent. The state of California may be about to execute an innocent man. That's the way the dissent starts, and it goes out for 57 pages. Documenting it painful. So Kevin Cooper's case fits the racism part, kills the NSRP. why does that relate to the propositions that we're about to vote on? Both of these propositions, well, especially 62, will do away with and post-conviction relief will be gone.
There are a couple of things that I think are important
to consider when we're talking about the fight against the death penalty, though, and that is that this is always a fight for the living. And that is in, you know, kind of in contrast to some of the more current kind of revolts that are happening against police violence right now, which are responses to police killings of people in the streets. Their responses to it, the fight for the fight against the death penalty is still a fight for those people that we see who are alive. And we can organize and we can actually do something to build an organization around it. And those fights are also intertwined. We went right from fighting on Stanford E. Williams' case and fighting in Kevin Cooper's case to also working on the case Oscar Grant. So doing Oscar Grant work almost immediately in Oakland at the same time that all of these other, after the death penalty work had been fully, put into place, but that's where that happened. Which brings us back again to, some of the differences in how to organize and why I think it's so important that we not just be against the death penalty, but that we also think about, well, what are we talking about replacing it with as well? Because this is a really tricky thing.
How am I doing?
Okay, sorry, I have 5 minutes. Maybe this is a good point to set it up for discussion. One of the big differences between the campaign and the death penalty and most of the other nonprofit groups, and these are people that were friends, they are and were friends of mine, so I'm not, and everything I'm going to tell you, I said to their faces when it matters, when we're doing work, so it's not like I'm saying something I wouldn't say to them, to their face, but the campaign and the death penalty always said, it's not our job to come up with the alternative punishment for a system that has abused people and put them in this position in the first place. If we're going to come up with any kind of a solution, we're going to say lots of money for pre-K, we're going to say lots of free education, we're going to say lots of free housing, we're going to say lots of free, we're going to say lots of jobs and employment for people. That's our response to what do we think the alternatives be. But all the other nonprofit groups that we were involved in felt compelled to say they were going to offer an alternative, and that alternative was life without the possibility of parole. Life without the possibility of parole basically takes human beings, and it's another form of the death sentence. It is another form of capital punishment, but it's just one where they rot in warehouses and sink to the bottom of the sea with no hope. And that, I think, is the problem with Prop 62. But it's an open debate. I think that's a good discussion we can have. One of the big differences between the campaign and the death penalty, and I'll end on this, and a lot of the other groups we worked with, is that we always said, who's going to be our spokespeople? Who are our spokespeople? The nonprofits always went to great man theory. Like, you always, if you're Italian, you're like, oh, couldn't possibly believe in the great man theory of history anymore, could you? But if you look at who are the spokespeople, it's Richard Brannon. Is the chief spokesperson right now. Mike Farrell, you guys are probably too young for MASH, but you probably heard of MASH, right? So he was DJ. And so Mike Farrell is running the Taxpayers for Sentencing Reform is the group behind 62. So he's taken time off from running the death penalty focus and is now running this campaign to get 62 passed. Who are our spokespeople? We always ended up speaking on behalf of prisoners, for the most part, because they are in prison. But we pioneered a thing called Life from Death Row, where death row inmates called in over the telephone and were able to address people. And in this case, the campaign to end the death penalty sent a questionnaire into both Chowchilla, which is where the 22 women who were on the row were at Chowchilla, and all 722 men who were on the row at St. Quentin. Send a questionnaire and saying, what do you think about these ballot initiatives? And we compiled their responses. It's on the website, so it's nodeathpenalty.org. And I have to say, I read through these responses, and it's very mixed. So it's not like the inmates are united in how they feel one way or the other. I'd say a preponderance of them are in favor of 62, which is life without possibility, but also gets them out of the executioner chamber. They are all universally opposed to 62. Well, not universally. Some of them are like, no, leave everything the way it is. I'm innocent. I just need an attorney. That's all I fucking need. need is an attorney, and I'm using their language, that's not, you know, I need an attorney, and I will be able to prove it. If they, if either one of these two things passes, I won't get any of that stuff, and I will die here. There's not a real clear, unanimous position from the inmates either on which way to go on. So I think it's up to us to have a political discussion about what's our take on this. You know, think about the six reasons. I hope that I've convinced you that it matters. If you only do one thing tonight, and I brought my little laptop so you could do it, there's a petition to Governor Brown that Kevin's last legal hope for clemency. So there is a petition that everybody can sign after the meeting is done. I hope I've convinced you to do that. You should vote no on 66, and I promise this will be the last.
Okay.
The reason why is because both ballot initiatives address the same question, the death penalty, which means that if they both go past 50%, whichever one of them gets the most yeses prevails. So it's very important for us to think about, like, unfortunately, a strategic thing we have to think about here. It's not just a clear case of are you in favor or opposed to death penalty, how do you feel about life without possibility of parole. It is a little more complicated, and I think that's a good fodder for discussion. So with that, I thank you for your time and attention, and I'll sit down and have a good time.
Awesome. Thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and keep stack. So if you have a comment or question, just raise your hand, and I'll give you about 3 minutes to speak, and I'll let you know when you have 30 seconds left so you can wrap up. And you can raise your hand while other people are speaking. I'll put you on the list, and hopefully we'll have a really great discussion.
So one thing you could consider adding is if we kill the ones we catch, the gang gets away. And so the death penalty is intrinsically the destruction of evidence. Most murders are the result of conspiracy. And so you're destroying the evidence, silencing the witness to the very crime that you're pretending to. So it is a crime in furtherance of what it pretends to pose. That's the logical reason. On the philosophical side, if we beat them at their own game, they have us playing their game. And that's what I have to keep in mind when I would say, well, let's get George H.W. Bush front and center on death row, and let's put W. and Cheney and get these guys, you know, who really deserve it, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right, but the counter to that is that they would have us playing their game. And on an inner side, if we're using death as a punishment, it's likely to be. So it's like a setup on just a personal philosophical level, you know, just taken outside of all other contexts. So I guess that's three different things that you might consider throwing in there. Especially, it's destruction of evidence. Especially the Clarence Ray Allen, because that's the Lee Furrow gang in operation. They framed Tukey to get him off the screen of Conan way back when, because he could actually bench press $500, and Arnold is a psychopathic groping Fuhrer steroid freak. Anyway.
I, for me, say, remember not to use the terminology or the framing or the language or the strategies or tactics of the oppressor. And a lot of times, because I'm a prison abolitionist, I've gotten sucked into it, and I don't want to not have accountability for police and murder people or anything, but prison, the death penalty or life in prison for kill a cop. But I don't want those things to be the solution we use. You know, that's not the way we want to frame things and the way we want the world to be. So it's difficult, but I think we have to think twice about what we are and what making it a transition, transforming things, and holding people like believe, accountable.
Alexandra?
Just a couple of questions about the proposition. So the first thing I have to realize is a proposition is either yes or no. And if it gets, if there's no no votes and yes votes, then it just fails, right? Like that.
So technically, they both have to get past 50% to be, but if they both make it past 50%, whichever one of them has more yeses will prevail because they both address the same section of the competition.
Oh, is that it?
Oh,
okay.
Have
you in the back?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to follow your logic. And actually, what people need to be aware of is more than one type of sometimes you have somebody to shoot somebody and try to pick the people, and everybody's no question, and they did it. Now, here's the question. Is the death penalty a moral punishment? That's when it's really happening. But what you have is, this is not just a capitalist society, this is racial capitalism built on slavery. So what you have is very often a racist prosecution of the prison. That's what we got with Kevin. And I want to, it's a little depressing because they have done some really good work, you know, for, you know, some legal work like that. And I would just like to refer you to the CNN film. CNN did a series on the death penalty. And they did one on Kevin Cooper, and I'm sorry if I'm telling the name of it, but I forgot the name of it. But Robert Redford was the producer for this particular episode. And they went through this whole situation because not only
about
yes vote on it, say it prevails, to get this change of law, you have to completely agree it's another, still another type of death sentence. You also have bought a lot of time because of neither pass, and what are they waiting for now? Cleaning up some ruling on lethal injection or sort of just getting the green light through to proceed with what's lawful killing? And what does it mean? I guess I'm just kind of raising the question, what does it mean when, you know, if the thought is to not want to vote yes on 62, and if that green light happens and they go and they start continuing with executions, and you say, well, that's the way to keep a movement going to actually get something better that might be the actual, you know, removing life without parole. You know, but if 62 gets through, then people kind of walk away and say, well, we resolved that, and there goes the political will to keep things moving. Mm-hmm. So try to vote or not, but, you know, it's just oftentimes there's, it seems like a lot of times, I mean, at least most legislation works through, comes in waves, and it's tough once you get something through once to get people still interested, even though it's obviously having to then convince people about this other issue. So just curious what people think on 62. If with the gamesmanship, we're playing with someone else's life, because the people who might be killed are obviously not the people voting, which is another issue, I guess, too. You know, who gets the vote? But just kind of interested to hear people think about 62.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I have questions kind of about that too, just the legal aspects. Because I get the critique on, or, you know, about movement, maybe stopping, or, you know, if we get, you know, death penalty is off the table, but then now we're stuck with this life, you know, life of parole and kind of what happens next. My question is legally, I don't know a ton, like, would it be hard more legally to then, after that is in law, to then go back and try to be like, never mind, you know, people don't want that. We were just, that was just a placeholder. Or would it be, like, is it the same? Would it be kind of just the same if we haven't done that? So.
I have someone sponsor on that, and then we'll see.
I think you're all kind of ready to start trying, but it's pretty practical in the sense that, like, when you put it as plain, you can't get it compliant, and you're able to stop, you know, the death penalty, even though this is not the best way to do it, it's all good. I'm full time here. So, I mean, you said a lot of you're getting more time, like Chris pointed out, and I think that's actually more, it's very, very valuable. But, you know, I think it would still be a huge challenge. I mean, the thing, as far as I understand it, once all the appeals are gone, the only person that can actually read these votes is the governor. And Jerry Brown, not only is he, you know, the most moderate of all the moderate Democrats, like, he's the one that brought the death penalty back to California to begin with. So, you know, like, it's kind of sad that, you know, that Kennedy in the 1980s was a son called California who growled about, you know, Governor Brown, and then all of a sudden he got that governor again. But I think, like, that really is going to be the challenge. It's not unheard of mass movements being able to basically force the state to release or pardon people that they didn't want to pardon. But at the same time, like, you know, those campaigns took years and took a lot of mass mobilizing. And I think that is something that we absolutely need to keep in mind. And, like, you know, one of the main reasons why Kevin does have good lawyers, but it was a statewide mobilization that mobilized, I mean, you're saying like hundreds of thousands of people. That's the only reason why Kevin Cooper's alive today. And if we're going to be able to free people like Kevin and the, you know, thousands of people like him, then that's the kind of movement that we need to try to build. And I think, like, that really does mean that we need to kind of, like, we should work with lawyers, but, like, lawyers can't be the ones determining how the campaign can be run. It's like mass campaigns actually save people's lives, free people, make a difference. And also, like, I think, especially nowadays, when, like, a lot of organizing is driven by nonprofits that don't look at that kind of model, it raises even bigger questions about how we're going to be able to build it. But I think that with Black Lives Matter, like, now, you know, a big factor, like, I think,
I just want to say two quick things. One, anybody who's new to this issue, I really want to participate and ask questions. I don't. There's clearly a lot of old timers in here. We've got a lot of opinions. We've talked about our opinions for a long time. But I want, this is really for new people too. So I really want people who have basic questions. I just really want to encourage people to be able to feel free to get into the conversation. And then just to say quickly that in case it's unclear, I think that even if somebody has a life without possibility of parole sentence, that means they're alive, and that means there's a possibility to fight for them. And I would never in a million years say that we should keep the death penalty so that we can like somehow keep a bigger movement going. If that in any way came across in any of my remarks, I want to tell you now that that's not what I was trying to say at all. Because as I said at the beginning, this is a fight for the living. As long as they're alive, we can fight. When they're executed, you can go back and try to prove a point, but it's really not going to do them any good, and it's not going to do us any good. It's much more about the fight for the living. And just to echo one thing that Alice ever said, because it's true, Gerald is absolutely right. Kevin has had some fantastic attorneys, and it took both. It took fantastic attorneys and a huge movement of people to stop his execution, but he's still on death row, and he's run out. There is no more runway for Kevin. The only thing left is this clemency petition. So yeah, I'm going to humble myself. I signed it. I'll grovel in front of Brown if that's what it is. If we get enough signatures and that's the thing that boosts and puts it over the touchdown line for Kevin Cooper, I'm not too proud. Do I think that's the solution, though? I think that all of us can agree that's not the real solution. But I'll humble myself to, if we're going to get, if that's what it's going to take. So.
Yeah, speaking of doing, what rules have been under petition, did we also have paper copies of the letter over there, which you can take home and either just sign it, mail, or adapt in your own words, if you'd like. I wanted to say something about sort of going off to Carol's mention about Christian capitalism and like connecting it back to like why is the socialist learning position talking about this? Because I think, if you look at what role the death penalty plays, right? Like, there's a reason why the system and the cops and the prosecutors defend it so strongly. And like Cameron pointed out, it's not because it deters crime. But I think it does play an important ideological role for them as a symbol. It's something that says to black people and, other people of color, poor people, but most importantly, I think, are most uniquely black people, that their lives don't matter. And that they... and that they better accept whatever little is given to them, or that will happen. And it's something that says to other people, white people, or anybody who imagines themselves as not as a potential victim of the death penalty, but as a, somebody who's kept safe by it, that their problems sort of are, because of people breaking the law, because of people not doing what the system wants them to do and not because of, the people in charge. And it's the way it turns, those people into scapegoats in a very, as brutal and spectacular way as possible in order to keep the attention there. And if you feel like that's what is necessary to keep you safe. So I think that's why it's important for people who want to actually change the system that we live in to fight against this edge of it. Just a couple of quick questions about 62. It's sort of like, I think I'm from this discussion, and it seems to make sense to me, I'm leaning in favor of supporting it, but I guess the argument begins with be that we already have a sort of de facto moratorium on the death penalty, haven't executed anybody for 10 years. So a question terms of whether it's worth, like, accepting the compromise of 62 is how likely do you think that is to continue versus whether they really are going to start executing people in a year or two otherwise. I don't know the answer to that, so I wanted to ask more people that opinion. And the other thought about
I didn't know. I honestly didn't know. Well, fuck, it was 1:30 before I got out of there, 700 something.
Oh, man. Now, it's true. Here's where you're right. So understand, there are two sides to every argument. Mounia did not like this law. He criticized the public. Kevin criticized the public. What they were saying was fight for a better arrangement. And they did change the law. I mean, the proposition. So they dropped some of that stuff. Yeah, they did. They changed the thing about how many appeals. It was supposed to be, they originally had a thing you could never appeal again. I want y'all to look at what's happening in the real world right now. Mounia, with all of the problems he got, I ain't gonna talk about his illness. Recently, there was a Supreme Court case for Williams versus State of Pennsylvania. Some poor brother they framed up, you know, and it wind up that homeboy, when he went to do his, you know, when you appeal, you have an appeal panel. The same prosecutor that prosecuted him was on the appeal panel. He said, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. So he took it, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, no good. That's unconstitutional. Now, after all these years, and I'm hoping that y'all hear me now, please help me out right now, because we have filed a thing for Mia. He can't find it. He already filed it. If we get some, this is where we do agree. That whatever they're going to do in the court, it's a mess. Right? The death penalty really, in my opinion, everybody got their thing, is terrible. Kill one, terrorize millions, right? But the point about Mounia and connecting it to this other thing is, okay, so Mounia winds up, when he went before Albert Sabo, Albert Sabo says, behind the court, I caught that case, and I'm going to help him try the next. So when we took that to the court, we said, this is slammed up. How are they going to not get his man up? Didn't work. Why? Because Castile was on the appeals panel. And so what we find is, I'll talk to anybody who wants to talk about this later. Being on the appeals panel has opened a path for Mounia. It's never too late to fight back as long as you still alive. Don't think.
Gerald, you really have to wrap it up.
But it's not just the abstract question. That's what I'm asking.
Bernie had a really quick question, and then I'm going to get back to Kim. I'm from Texas originally, so when David brought up the fact that execution had happened in California for 10 years, that's really not going to be interesting. I think it's definitely a thing that would lead to. So I guess part of my question, and I was understand the whole legal proceedings behind something like death row. But I guess I was interested in maybe hearing this one, something that I think you should talk to much more, just hearing more about the history of death row here in California. Because it seems to me that, again, the idea behind 62 here and would be, it's a strategic or a tactical, because it doesn't address the actual issue as a whole. It's sort of this trying to find a political way of addressing and helping people in the present. And so for me, the question of whether to abstain or whether to vote forward would be about what actually helps them the most in the present. Based off of, again, sort of my gut, based off of, again, maybe some nice better understanding of Texas would sort of be sort of saying, of course, sort of getting a kind of state of execution, even if it's through some process, too, would obviously help better the process by getting more time. But then again, the question that David brought up, which I guess is really important, is sort of, what are the sort of, I guess, the immediate dangers to those people, the process that could actually address those, or the decisions that helps sort of press it for the future cases. So, that's my question.
The reason why I'm bringing people along is because it turns out this room ends for us at 8 o'clock. So we're not trying to shut you down. We're just trying to say, like,
no, it's all right.
Yeah,
right.
We're ramming up here. Because I want the last word. So basically, as long as people are alive, we can fight for them. What makes prostitution so problematic is that it costs $3.1 million to get signatures to put this thing on the ballot. And it is an amendment to the California Constitution. The only way life without the possibility of parole will ever go away in California is if it is again put on the ballot and the Constitution is amended. So this is not just like we can fix it sometimes pretty easily later. The legislature cannot amend this. It would have to go back on the ballot, which is what raises the level of like seriousness of when you say
Are you going to permanently enshrine, because I'll tell you what's going to happen. We will never, I believe that it will be a very long time, and this is, nobody ever knows for sure what's going to happen, but life without the possibility of parole, to raise $3 million to get it on the ballot again, will be a very large hurdle to pass. And there will be a lot of people who are going to catch LWOP and will spend the rest of their natural life in prison. Let us not be mistaken that, like, just because you're innocent or there was a problem in your case, that everybody's going to get Mubia's little, you know, hitch along. No, this will entomb and sink to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean a huge number of people who will never see the outside of prison again in their life. That's what life without possibility of will mean in California when 62 happens. The reason LWOP is part of 62 is because most of the activists who are sincerely opposed to death penalty said we have to find some alternative. We have to make this palatable to the most conservative people in our state, or else we'll never get anything. And so it's that kind of compromise, which I would say is a very serious and dirty compromise, which is why LWOP is in 62 and what makes it so sincerely problematic. Having said all of that, when people are alive, we can fight for them, even if they are entombed, and even when they're sunk in the bottom of the ocean, if they're alive, we can still try to reach them. And it doesn't mean that our society will not ever change. There was a time when there was no death penalty in California. In my lifetime, there was a time when there was no death penalty here. And we can do it again if we have a social movement. It's the social movement that's the important thing, not whether or not this or that ultimately ballot initiative passes. So for those reasons, I would probably say I'm leaning towards voting for 62 because I'd rather douse the immediate flames in order to live to fight another day than to abstain and let 66 go forward, which will be, again, which will require a ballot initiative to amend the Constitution if it passes and is enshrined in law. That will immediately speed up the process. So, as well, we haven't taken an official position. I really do want to thank everybody for coming out. We're going to go hang out somewhere else after this, and we can talk. We can continue the conversation. Lori, look at my poster that I brought. And, you know, have guys, that's an exercise for us to do and everything like that. So, but I still want the last word, so go ahead, and I'm going to talk after you.
Were these two measures as 62 and 66, were they on the ballot before we put those numbers?
It was 34 when it was tried the first time around.
Okay, thank you. That's
all. All right. Thanks, everybody. For the International Socialist Organization, get a copy of Social Scorecard and talk to us next week.